Welcome, everybody, to the Locked On Lakers podcast. I'm Anthony Irwin. I'm joined by Pete Zayas. Pete, your fun hypothetical question of today is, if you were to find out that pineapple on pizza, specifically, not cooked pineapple, cured or acted like a vaccine for coronavirus, are you still being that stubborn about it?
No, I will eat the vaccine, your pineapple vaccine.
What if like
you're a twisted motherfucker, man. Like
what if
that's where you go to get me? No.
Wearing Celtics green and rooting for the Celtics.
No.
That's where still I'm still not doing it. Bring it on.
Nice try, Anthony.
How you doing, bud?
I was better like a minute ago.
We're off to a roaring start here. Today's show, we are going to kick off the Lakers March Madness bracket here at the end of March. We're going to be doing a May Madness bracket, looks like. But today's today's matchup is going to be between the 2000 and 2001 Los Angeles Lakers, one of the greatest teams of all time, and the 2012-2013 Los Angeles Lakers, one of the greatest disappointments of all time. That should just about kind of get us ready for whatever it is. However, we see those teams matching up. The matchup itself shouldn't be that difficult one, a choice, I guess. But talking about these teams should be fun nonetheless. What's the number one thing? So we're going to start by talking, obviously, about the 2000-2001 team. We'll spend a little bit of time about the 2012-2013 team. And then at the end of it, kind of make our decision, compare the two teams, whatever. But what's the one thing you remember from the 2000-2001 team?
I mean, that playoff run, right? Like, that's a legendary playoff run right there that really is – when I think of really great – Laker teams of all time, just great teams of all time. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's like they were really good in that regular season, right? But the peak that they hit was just absolutely stunning. It's some of the best basketball I've ever seen, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you had a couple injuries. Derek Fisher was hurt for a good portion of that season. He was actually the third leading scorer on that team, scored 11.5 points a game. You know, Kobe played like 68 games. Shaq played 74. It was, you know, relatively healthy. But that was the year when we had traded out, not literally by trade, but basically Horace Grant was now our starting power forward rather than AC Green. Mm-hmm. And Grant was already old at that time, but he was a lot better than AC was at the same point. And so by the time the playoff rolled around, really, if you watch the tape on the Portland series the season before, where we won in the game 7, Shaq, Kobe, Lob, and all that, Portland cheated hard off of AC Green and Ron Harper. Mm-hmm. And Harper was still there and still started for portions of the season, right? With Fisher being out. But the Lakers kind of sliding Grant a little into a more prominent role, Fisher into a more prominent role, especially in the playoffs when he was healthy again. Kind of teams no longer had that ability to just cheat way off of a couple of guys that they weren't afraid of at all. And that's when like the full fury of Shaq and Kobe got released in the playoffs. So that's like, I just remember that so fondly because they were freaking unstoppable in that playoff run.
Another huge addition to that team was Slava Medvedenko. this was his rookie year. I thought he made all the difference, but it was actually kind of funny because if I remember correctly, there was a little concern about replacing Glenn Rice because he was a big part of the success that the team before that the year before had. And, you know, obviously when you have Shaq, you want as much good shooting around him as possible, even though at that time we didn't really think of it as much that way. We just thought like, I don't know. Can you think back on how you thought about basketball at the time? Like when did the concept of spacing and stuff first kind of dawn on you?
Oh, that was not, I mean, at that period of time, you had like Doug Moe. Well, this is later than that. Basically, teams that shot a bunch of threes were considered weak. sustainable and soft, right? And you had to win the inside game, and really those were the best players in the league, right? Were the Shaqs and David Robinson and Olajuwon, yeah. And this is after Jordan had retired at this point. Even Kevin Garnett, right? You had some perimeter players, but they were way more like, now when we think of the top guys, they're all perimeter ball handlers, really, right? Kawhi and LeBron, Giannis, all these guys. And now Giannis has that big man size, but just in terms of how he plays, it was really different. So like the idea of spacing, like, yeah, you needed to be able to shoot, but it was nowhere near what it is now, man. It was just a totally different game.
Yeah. Think about this. This to me, you know, like 16-1 sounds crazy. Was it actually a 16-1 or was it 15-1? It was.
I think that was
15-1.
15-1. Yeah.
Yeah.
They hadn't gone to 7 games yet in the first round.
But 15-1 in and of itself in the playoffs is insane by itself, right? Mm-hmm. But you think about the teams that they went through in those playoffs. The Trailblazers in the first series, which they faced them in the Western Conference Finals the year before. Mm-hmm. The Sacramento Kings, who were like at about as good as they ever were, right? In that they might have gotten a little bit better the next year. And then the San Antonio Spurs, who just 2 years prior had swept the Lakers and won a championship, right? Mm-hmm. And you had prime Tim Duncan and all that. And then, you know, obviously Philly, the Eastern Conference, like that final championship was basically like the I would compare it to having a round of drinks before you go out and party, right? Like the uh-huh. party's on the other side of this. You just got to like get yourself into the buzz. Like, I think
that's right.
And the like Lakers treated game one like that, basically. Game one was obviously disappointing. The Lakers were that close to doing the incredible and just sweeping through the playoffs. But overall, yeah, I just that run, I don't think we'll ever see anything quite like it ever again. That was just incredible. And, you know, I actually think part of why we might not see something like it again is because the Lakers were almost a little bit ahead of their time. Like, if you look at the way that they shot in the postseason.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's modern type numbers. Like, this is actually why I think this team would be able to hold their own, if not beat the Warriors, the Kevin Durant Warriors.
I love this idea that I very much agree that team in particular was the most translatable into the modern era, because it's from 20 years ago, right? Or nearly 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those teams couldn't hold up, but you can still have at least one dominant big man, but the ability to space the floor, like you said, with Robert Horry, had Fox and Kobe, but still like strong wing defense and perimeter defense around that. It would be interesting to see, can you have a guy who can't defend the perimeter really at all in Shaq? Can you still do that? But like all things considered, yeah, man, that's a great point about the kind of translatability of that team into future eras.
Yeah, I really think, because you go down the playoff 3-point percentages in that year, right? Kobe went 32%, only shooting about 2 per game. Fisher
was bonkers, man.
52% from 3-point range. Again, only on four attempts or whatever. Rick Fox.
That was a lot for that time, man.
Yeah.
Like, that led the team. That was a lot of attempts per game in the playoffs, especially.
Rick Fox at 32%, basically, at about four shots per game. Robert Horry at 36% at 3 attempts per game. Brian Shaw at 35-ish% at 2 attempts per game. Like that, nobody's going to beat any Shaq team if the role players around him are shooting like that from 3-point range. Like, that's just not going
to happen. And you know, you look at that now, like a lot of those guys are around 34-35%, which is like fine, right? Mm-hmm. But in that era, when you can put 4 guys on the court who can do that next to freaking Shaq, that made all the difference in the world. And Kobe freaking Bryant, by the way, right? Like,
yeah.
And that's why just like getting AC and having Ron Harper play a significantly reduced role. He only played in six games in the playoffs in 2001. He just gotten old and he wasn't a shooter, right? Putting shooting around Shaq and Kobe at that point, man, it was all over. And those teams they beat on the way, man, those were each of our like main rivals of that era, right? It was Portland, San Antonio, Sacramento. Those were our three Western Conference rivals. And we whooped them one after another after another, man. I will, till the day I die, man, that will be one of the funnest sports experiences of just like watching your team. Because like there's a certain thrill to like watching your team win a game seven or something like that. There's an entirely different thrill to watching your team kick the shit out of the team that's across from them. That was one of those years. It was freaking great.
Shaq's numbers for the playoffs, 30 points per game, 15 rebounds a game, 3 assists, about a half a steal, 2.5 blocks, shooting 56% from the field. Kobe goes for 29.5 per game, 6 assists, 7.5 rebounds. He got to the free throw line 9.5 times per game, which
Shaq at 12.5.
Yeah, it was just that, like I said, I really don't think we're ever going to see a team that dominant in the postseason again. For one thing, I think we're seeing, you know, the talent disbursement a little bit different, know, now than it was. Like there's more talent across these rosters, I think, now than there were in that era. But again, that was a modern team. Like that was a 1-4 around a big outside team, and that they were able to execute it to that kind of extreme just makes it that much funnier that Phil gives those modern teams a hard time. I wouldn't say this is my favorite team of all time, but this is definitely the best team I've ever seen play basketball.
Yeah, well, that playoff run, right? Like, yeah, that's the best stretch of basketball I've ever seen a team play. The 2014 Spurs were up there. They just weren't as talented as that Lakers team, right? They didn't have, because at that point, Duncan was old. They didn't have, like, superstars playing at the height of their game. But just in terms of pure basketball porn, they were up there too. But yeah, but the Lakers having two superstars doing that, I'm right there with you.
Yep. All right, let's take a quick second here. When we come back, we're going to go to the other end of the spectrum, a superstar-laden team that didn't live up to expectations. So what was cool about 2000-2001 was that was a team reach its pinnacle, right? Climb the mountaintop and just take a crap all over that mountain. And 2012-2013 Lakers, it's the opposite of that. So we'll get to that here in a bit. All right, so now we're going to talk about the 2012-2013 year, the Dwight Mayer year, the season from hell. Like, it's just like this season inspired me to start talking about the Lakers because I got so frustrated watching them. Angry. Yeah, like they were so frustrating. They were so maddening. And I didn't have an outlet to talk about them that I finally logged onto Twitter and bugged Harrison and at that time Drew Garrison so much until they gave me a spot on Silver Screen and Roll. So that's what I remember these guys for. What do you remember 2012-2013 for?
Yeah, profoundly frustrating season that turned – kind of exciting and then fell off a cliff when Kobe got there, right? Mm-hmm. We get Dwight first, and then we're like, all right, we're going to get Nash. And so the idea at the time is Nash was really good the year before with Phoenix. He was not a superstar anymore. We knew the Lakers had overpaid too, right? Mm-hmm. Because it was like, hey, this is final piece of the puzzle. Dwight Howard was considered to be the best
pick and roll big trade or the Anthony Davis trade.
Right, exactly. Something where you're like, yeah, you know, you got to give up a lot to be able to get this final piece. So the Lakers traded, what was it, 2 first rounders and 2 second rounders, I think, for the right to sign Nash, who was a free agent, but they needed to do it via sign and trade. So they needed Phoenix's cooperation. You know, you get the old brilliant pick and roll guard to go with the most athletic, best rolling big man in the NBA. Could also
spot up and shoot if Kobe wanted to run the pick and roll.
If Kobe wanted to run it, right? You had, you know, Artest on the wing, who has met a world peace at that point. And you had Pau. So you had this like great combination of power and skill. Mm-hmm. In terms of Nash and Kobe, you know, Powell and Dwight, but they went 0-8 in preseason, right?
Yeah,
and it's like, oh, like, oh, it's preseason, but 0-8, huh? Like, like, and y'all didn't look good at any point, and
right?
None of it was like really clicking. Then they start the season, 2-5, mm-hmm. and fire Mike Brown. So it's like, oh crap, right? Like Mike Brown's trying to run the Princeton offense, and it's kind of this like last second change where he'd been going through training camp, not entirely doing that. And then, like kind of changes direction. It's like, oh, this is not good. Mm-hmm. And just like the vibes around it were, ugh. And then they were like around 500 for 50, 60 games, something like, or like, 50, yeah, I think it was about 50 games. Mm-hmm. Then the Kobe goes on this bonkers run, doesn't let D'Antoni take him out of the game, and just like all the and then how we hired D'Antoni. I'm sorry, I could rant and ramble about this season in particular, because like the way we hired D'Antoni, we can get into the whole. We've talked about this recently, like. Right. To Phil, like, don't freaking call Phil Jackson if you don't plan on hiring him.
Yeah.
He's won 11 titles at this point. What are you doing? And then it's terribly unfair to terribly unfair to D'Antoni to do that. Anyway. So it's just this freaking by the way, Steve Nash shatters his freaking shin in the second game, which I think was underrated in the remembrance of this
absolutely.
Season.
Absolutely.
I don't know. That's my overview. It was just one of those like cursed type of seasons that and even then, had Kobe not torn his Achilles, I still wonder what, because they were on a pretty good roll at that point.
So some of these range anywhere from just funny moment to actual bright spot. But I remember that season got kicked off by Spectrum had just launched. Right. And they had this big like Spectrum launch party that was televised, and the guys were coming in to sit on the couch with Geeter, and Geeter was giving this interview with Steve Nash, Dwight Howard, and Kobe, which already struck me as odd that Powell wasn't going to be in on that. Like that right from the get-go, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, that's a little weird. And then so they had like the interview was basically like the three guys were talking about what the season might be like. And then at one point, they showed clips of Kobe dunking on Nash, and then they showed a clip of Kobe dunking on Dwight. And you could tell, like, Nash is really good at this, so he just kind of played it off and just kind of said, you know, he got me there, I rotated over. It was the play where Lamar like Odom made the crazy pass from his behind. Kobe got the ball and just dunked all over Nash in the playoff game.
Yeah.
And Nash, you know, he said, like, I tried to take a charge, got there a step too late. Kobe's just so athletic that he was able to get there and you know, played it off. And then they showed the play from Dwight's rookie year, I believe. And mm-hmm. I think it was a preseason game, if I remember.
No, it was a regular season game in Orlando.
Oh, Ben Wallace Ben Wallace was the preseason game.
The preseason. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dwight was in the regular season.
So again, like, you know, Dwight tries to play it off, but you could kind of tell like that didn't sit very well with him. And that was and then I think after that they had opening day, or they had the media day, and you know, they asked Nash, how's the leadership gonna handle it? Oh, we're all on the same team, we're all playing for the same goal, we'll all be leaders at different times. And Powell, how is the leadership thing going to go? Oh, well, you know, the same thing Nash said. Dwight, how's it going to go? Well, you know, I'm coming from, I had a pretty successful run here. Nash has been 2-time MVP. Powell's a great international player. I think we'll all figure it out. Kobe, how's the leadership going to be? No, this is my fucking team. Uh-huh. And like, you know, you combine, it was just the vibe around the team was already weird enough. And then, like you said, they go 0-8 in preseason. They go 0-5, I believe, to start the regular season and fire Mike Brown. That the beginning of that year could not possibly have gone worse. Like, there's no way. What's up?
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Finish that point, because I've got a question for you after that.
Well, I just think that the beginning of that year, like, if you were to try to, you know, kind of cook it up, or if you were writing a script for, like, how badly can something go, that's about how it would go, because it featured Nash breaking his leg, and then, you know, Mike Brown clearly being in over his head, and a group of guys that kind of needed a Nash kind of presence and didn't have it, and it really showed. But yeah, go ahead. What were you going to ask?
Well, why do you think Kobe took that this is my fucking team approach?
Because it was finally his fucking team, right? It was finally like, well, they won the two championships, right? And like he had coexisted with Shaq. And now felt, I would imagine, for the rest of his career, was probably thinking, I'm never going to have to do that again. And, you know, and had success not doing it. So I would imagine, I think that went into it.
My theory, because that was, I mean, he split up with Shaq like 8 or 9 years before that, right? So he had experienced more of being the alpha, the main guy, the leader, than the years he had had with Shaq. My theory is that, like, he felt... I've been rewatching the 2010 finals, and in context with that, been watching some 2008 as well. And I think Kobe felt an obligation to toughen up Dwight Howard in particular. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Powell had already accepted Kobe's leadership. They already had that dynamic of Kobe as the leader, Powell as his second in command. And so that dynamic was comfortable and established. Steve Nash was able to fit in just fine, I think, personality-wise, right? It was physical issues that he had. But he had been around for long enough to where that was not. Like, he knew that was Kobe Bryant's freaking team. Kobe had been there since 1996, and we're in 2012 at this point with media day. Dwight Howard, however, was used to being the man and being the most important guy. I think Kobe looked at Dwight the same way that he looked at Powell the first time around, and he had success with kind of toughening up Powell, right? And getting Powell to buy into the mentality that Kobe had. And that's what you always say about sports teams, right? Is that, like, the best ones really follow the mentality of their leaders. And Dwight was not used to being led. Yeah. And so Kobe's kind of acerbic, like, I'm not trying to parse words or be diplomatic. Like, I'm going to tell you you're being freaking soft to your face, and, like, you need to step up your game. I think he tried to treat Powell in a way where Dwight's personality was so different that it clashed. But I do think that – I don't think it was necessarily an ego thing with Kobe any more than anything would be. Just like, I've won 5 championships at this point. You two have combined for 0. Mm-hmm. And I've actually beaten you on the way to those. Mm-hmm. So, like, shut up, listen, and learn from me. And that approach did not really jive with where Dwight was at in his career.
Yeah, I think Dwight could have handled taking the lesson better, obviously. He would say that, right? Like, that's something that he would probably say. But I also think Kobe delivering the message, like, you have 82 games to figure out how to toughen up, or if somebody's taking the message. At some point there, if you're going to keep with the tough love thing, like, you deserve some criticism for continuing down that path when you see it's not registering. And I think it was pretty clearly not registering for large chunks of basically all that year. The final kind of highlight, an actual bright spot here, is that, you know, especially, I don't think we're getting it now that it's stupid that we aren't, or that this caused it. But since Kobe died, we aren't getting as much stupid Kobe conversations anymore. But before that, one of the things that I always kind of tried to push back on was the idea that Kobe couldn't evolve, if need be, to the modern game, the spacing game, being more of a facilitator. That stretch before he tore his Achilles was some of the best basketball, but some of the best just all-around amazing basketball that not just Kobe has ever played, but that we have ever really seen. Right. You know, when I hear this stuff like Harden is a better offensive player and this and that and the other, I and they point to his assists and stuff like that, I always kind of say, I kind of feel if Kobe was given the wide open lane and the refereeing style that Harden was gets now, we would the point would sound asinine, right? And this is kind of what I point to as the foundation of that. I know that Kobe could pull this off.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Kobe in the modern game and being raised in the modern game, you just take the same mentality and apply it in different ways.
Yeah.
So maybe instead of spending hours upon hours, like Rob Pelinka told this great story about how he saw Kobe. And, you know, with Pelinka's stories can sometimes be big fish stories.
Yeah.
But this is very – like there are enough people beyond Pelinka that have told similar stories that like, yes, this is totally Kobe, of like him working for like – an hour or two on just a jab step out of triple threat in the, you know, in the high post.
Mm-hmm.
And just like the footwork on like how you angle your foot, how, you know, you plant your on the balls of your feet so you can spring back off of it. Yeah. Just all of the little minutiae of like how to be
your hips, just in case that's where the defensive player is focused.
Right. So that is less of an important part of today's game. So what if he's spending that time instead working on pull up threes against drop coverages in a pick and roll the way you might see today, right? Or God, Kobe in an era of switching the way that we do now.
Yeah.
Like Kobe ate switches up, man. Yeah,
so many mouse in the house things, like they just would not fly.
Right. And even with bigs on the perimeter, right?
Yeah.
Like he had freaking wings crossing, doing circles and chasing their tail and crossing their feet up.
Paul
like,
George famously. Embarrassed.
Right. He would have embarrassed some big dudes, right? So yeah, like that's why, again, we were talking about the all-time greats conversation a couple days ago, that those type of things go into it, right? What if Kobe applies that crazy work ethic to being like the D'Antoni-type ball handler of a James Harden, right, rather than spending all of it, you know, in a 90s type of mentality. So, yeah, I think about that all the time. And Kobe eventually adapted. And, man, before that Achilles, like that Raptors game, you remember that game against the Raptors where he single-handedly brought him back? He had a crazy game in Atlanta, I recall, during that stretch. I think Dante Jones injured him in that. Maybe I'm misremembering that. Anyway, yeah, Kobe, like, finally adapting was just a sight to behold.
Yep. All right, let's take a quick second here. When we come back, we'll do some comparison. It's not really much of a comparison to be made here, but we'll see what we can do here in the third segment to put a cherry on top of this conversation. All right, so the conversation in terms of like which was the better team, the greater team here, that's pretty straightforward, right? We're going to put this out to a Twitter poll, and we'll get enough votes for the 2000-2001 team is going to be able to move on. But let's hypothetically say, A, Nash doesn't break his leg, right? And it allows this 2012-2013 team to live up to, if not our expectations, but a realistically closer place to what we would have hoped for from this team, you know, because the 2000-2001 team, like that team did reach its pinnacle, like that 15 mm-hmm. game stretch or those 15 wins, that's the best that team could have possibly played. If we were to put that team against, say, the best version of this team, does this team have any chance whatsoever of competing with that 01 team?
No.
None.
Sorry, I'm supposed to stretch that out for the sake of content, but
no, all right, man, that'll do it for this episode.
Yeah. You know, we can look at teams and rosters and like, oh, this guy was that type of player, this guy was this type of player,
mm-hmm.
but like chemistry and cohesion are difficult to measure, especially when you're looking back on paper. Like, it wasn't just that team was talented in 2001. It was they played so well together that collectively, like, they were greater than the sum of their parts collectively.
Which was already an insane sum of their parts. Right.
Their parts were nuts. And then that insane chemistry. That's, ugh, bro, I hope this season comes back. I can't tell which year this team reminds me of. Like, in some ways, this Lakers team this season that just got suspended reminded me of the 2008 team. But in other ways, it's like, oh, they've got maybe some ability to go on a hellified run, right? Because they get along. They like really like can they have some 2000 or maybe even 2001 type vibes to them. So yeah, just that. More than anything from a talent perspective, is just such a massive difference. Those are two opposite ends of the spectrum on chemistry. And yeah. I think that's why it wouldn't be particularly close.
Yeah, I would agree. If we were to just kind of play this game in a vacuum, I could see why at least, because again, theoretically speaking, right, that 2012-2013 team, it was a shallow roster. It wasn't, you know, top to bottom, it wasn't a very good team. You had Steve Blake was the backup point guard, who was okay-ish, but by that, you know, he was Steve Blake. Earl Clark, who, you know, went on to earn a pretty nice contract because of Mike D'Antoni's system. Chris Duhon was on that team. Devin Ebanks, Andrew Gottlock, Jordan Hill, and a past his prime, Anton Jameson, Darius Johnson Odom, Jody Meeks, Darius Morris. I know Darius was a huge fan of this team. There's so many Darii. And then you had, you know, obviously, Steve Nash, Sacre, and you know, Metta World Peace was the best role player on the team. In theory, the starting five, I think, just on talent alone, they might have had some moments where, hey, this looks like, decently evenly matched. But once you go to the bench there, and you're relying on any Duhon minutes whatsoever or any Earl Clark minutes whatsoever, you're in real trouble. It's not going to go very well. I really thought that starting five was going to be one of the best five-man groups in the history of basketball. It had everything. Even Powell at that point, like, he was kind of reluctant about it, but he could knock down 16, 17 footers, and he was happy to take them. He wasn't going to step out and hit threes, and he was oddly, you know, stubborn about not wanting to do that, but you know, in terms of how a power forward was expected to space the floor at that time, he was all right at it. And then you had Metta, who was going to be kind of the physical, like, bruiser defender for just in case they faced off against LeBron. Obviously, Kobe and Nash. Now, Kobe wasn't going to help space the floor very much for Nash, but it wasn't like you weren't not going to guard Kobe while he was on the court. And then when Kobe had the ball, Nash could definitely space the floor. Like, he had a ton of gravity to him, too. So, like, just in theory, this was like, it made so much sense. I was so freaking excited for that year because I thought that team was going to be just one of the best or most talented teams in the history of the sport. And then, you know, everything that could have gone wrong didn't just go wrong, but went, like, as wrongly as it could have gone wrong. You know, Nash didn't just, like, sprain his knee. He shattered that motherfucker.
Yeah, right? Yeah. No, it was his shin, right?
Right. Yeah, you know, like, Powell didn't just not get along with Mike D'Antoni. One of the first things that we remember in the relationship between Powell and Mike D'Antoni was D'Antoni benched him late in one of the games and was asked about it afterward, and he said, because I was trying to win, right? Like, it wasn't just that he didn't get along with Powell. It's that they were like, and this is Powell. Powell never gets angry at anybody. And
right.
He was like,
this is also like two-time champion Powell too, right?
Right.
Where that part of the problem with bringing D'Antoni in is that the leaders of that team and the guys who'd been there the longest with Kobe and Powell are like, Kobe's like, I've won five. And Powell's like, I've won two. D'Antoni hasn't won shit.
Right.
You know, like, why are we supposed to change? Which isn't to say, like, there was a lot of validity in what D'Antoni said, as evidenced by where the league went from there on out. Mm-hmm. But, like, you have to, sometimes it doesn't matter if you're right. You have to be able to make your case and get people on board, which is not something that if you get Pau Gasol, like you're saying, man, if you get Pau Gasol mad at you and not wanting to play hard for you and all that, that's a failure of leadership right there.
Yeah.
Right. It doesn't matter if he was technically right in terms of basketball concepts. You got to get the people on board. That's or else you being technically right doesn't matter. But one thing I will say from a on-court standpoint that, in looking back on it, I think that team was somewhat doomed, even if Kobe stayed healthy, it's because they were slow. They did not have they didn't have great foot speed, and they didn't have the ability to change it up quite the way that other teams had. You know, Lamar was already gone. Those title teams were able to go Powell at center with Lamar at the four, and now you've got this like fast, skilled, more perimeter centric lineup. Meadow was slow for the three. Kobe had started to slow down just in terms of foot speed, right?
Yeah.
Steve Nash and Duhon, all those guys, everybody at their position, with the exception of Dwight Howard, was slower than the average player. They were very good players, but I think that that's something that pops up. We saw that in 2004 against the Pistons too. That's a big reason why I think even if Karl Malone stayed healthy, I think the Pistons win, is they were just faster at mm-hmm. that point. They were fast. And that's such an underrated part of basketball, is speed relative to your opponent, that I think that that 2013 team was kind of doomed, even if Nash would have stayed healthy.
This was also the season that I'm kind of remembering it, because I was thinking, like, Steve Blake was actually an all right backup point guard, but he missed a lot of time. Do you remember how he got hurt?
I do not.
He stepped on, so you know when you're pulling out of parking lots? Mm-hmm. They have those things where it's like, do not reverse or severe, you'll get severe tire damage. Those spikes there, he stepped on a spike. It went through his sandal, basically went through Jeez. His foot. Yeah.
That's right. That's yeah. right.
So I'm thinking like, yeah, Steve Blake should have been fine. Like they should have been able to handle some right. of the time when Nash was down, but he missed because he only played in 45 games himself. Yeah, he played in 45 games. Nash played in 50. So that means we got a whole bunch of Chris Duhon and Jody Meeks.
That season was so cursed. That freaking season, man.
Yeah. Well, that was the beginning of, and this is probably going to, like, my chances of ever getting hired by Spectrum were already pretty slim, but this is probably the hammer in the nail of that. but that was the beginning of the Spectrum curse, right? Like, they have not come close to competing since they partnered with Spectrum. And that was the beginning of it. And then now, in the final year, the year that they actually really have a chance, you get a global pandemic. So, if we have anybody that we're looking to blame here, you know, I'm just...
I hate you sometimes. I really do.
I really hope nobody from that channel is listening. All right, so final thing, though, before we talked a lot about that 2012-2013 team, that 2000-2001 team, do you think another team of the other squads that we're going to, you know, talk about over the course of this bracket will come close to, you know, basketball-wise competing with that 2000-2001 team?
Lakers have had some really amazing teams, man, and yeah. it's a matter of yeah, it's a matter of how do you adjust like the 87 team?
Yeah.
To, you know,
contextualize it compared to, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, no, the Lakers have other teams in the conversation. Yes, I truly believe they do.
All right. All right. I'm looking forward to it. This was fun. Was this okay? Was this an okay way to go about this exercise?
I like this. Yeah. Like we started with kind of a easy breakaway layup, right? In terms of the matchup. We'll debate more on the other ones for sure.
If somebody on that 2012-2013 had gotten this kind of a wide open layup, they would have missed it. They would have missed it and sprained an ankle.
Probably.
All right, that's going to do it for this episode and this week's episodes of the Locked On Lakers podcast. Thank you guys very much for tuning in. Like I said, we're going to try to get through this, we've been saying, we're going to try to get through this as creatively as we possibly can. We need your help, though. So if you guys have questions, it doesn't have to be about basketball. I asked Pete, that didn't make the chopping block. But I, at one point, asked Pete about his guilty pleasure. I asked Harrison about his guilty pleasure on yesterday's show. So if you guys have any questions about just about anything, put them in the form of a 5-star review on iTunes, or send them over to us on Twitter, via email, via any way that you mailing pigeon. Just make sure that's a nice clean envelope when you send it, and we will talk to you then. Have a great rest of your weekend. Make somebody else's. We'll talk to you on Monday.